Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The 1335 Virgin Train service to Manchester Piccadilly is now running boarding at platform 13. This service will call at Stoke-on-Trent, Stockport and Manchester Piccadilly. The 1335 Virgin Train service to Manchester Piccadilly is now running boarding at platform 13.
So I often end up in a YouTube spiral. I mean, it's 2 a.m. and I'm watching someone break down a bluefin tuna. But one morning I had a video pop up and I'd never seen the channel before. And now it's uncommon because, again, I'm up till 2 a.m. watching bluefin tuna videos. I've seen everything. So I watched that video that popped up and then another and then another. Classic YouTube spiral. I mean, I was seeing all of these videos, but they were all talking about the exact same thing, being autistic. Now, one channel stood out, Adulting Autistic, run by Tyler Grant here in the UK, up in Manchester. I mean, after watching her videos, I knew I had to chat to her.
This kid really does look like a serial killer. Obviously, not saying autistic people are serial killers. Like, I'm autistic. I am not a serial killer.
Yeah.
Every guy I've told ghosts around the time I tell them. Not saying that's
why. Well, I'm really sensitive to sound, which is quite laughable because I love techno nights, which are usually quite loud. And the fact that there's a lot of variables and it's like what goes in what wash and like what's the right answer.
Bridge, like I can hear it. Maybe if I put you really close, you'll hear it too.
I'm Tyler, I'm 22, and I guess I'd call myself an autism activist. That's the most fitting word, yeah.
You have lots of different phrases like autistic, with autism. Like, how do you sort of work it out? Are there any different...
What to use?
Yeah, like what sort of phrasing to use?
Depends on the context. If you're talking about a person, it's an autistic person. That's a preference on... Like, that's the most dominant preference in the community. But some people do like to be called someone with autism. To me personally, I'm not really bothered because I'd rather us be talking about it and then I can fix what would appear to you as semantics later. But there is a lot of weight behind that. So if you're saying with autism, you're assuming that autism's a bad thing, more than likely. And then if you're saying autistic person, then your perception is that I view autism as something that defines me. And yes, it does define me. It's my brain. Like, I've grown up, I have this, like, it's in me. I can't disassociate from it. You can't cure it. So wait, it is an identity. Like, it's like, I'm black, I'm a woman. Like, these are parts of me that I don't wish to change and I'm not going to change, and to some extent I can't change.
What would you say autism is?
I would say it's an umbrella term for it's an umbrella term for someone impacted by a number of traits is how I define it. But generally it's like, what do they say it is? A developmental delay or something like that. But I don't agree with that. The science may say that, but it doesn't feel like that.
What does it feel like for you?
It generally just feels like day to day, I feel like my personal ability and on paper is completely different to how I actually would be in a situation, because when you're in a situation, you've got the environment to factor in, you've got the social things to factor in, and then you've got just the general condition of like your state and your body and stuff.
Hi, I'm Mary Ajapong. I'm a researcher in neurodevelopmental psychology
at King's College London. I'm working on looking for early signs and symptoms of autism and ADHD in infant siblings who have an autistic brother or sister. So I guess from sort of the research perspective, autism would be defined as a neurodevelopmental disorder, and it's sort of characterized by difficulties with social communication, as well as difficulties with repetitive and restricted behaviors and interests, and also sensory interests. And so it's quite a broad sort of definition. It's also important to remember that all of, like, it's essentially diagnosed behaviorally, and so these, like, it's autism's a construct in a sense.
What do you mean, like, a construct?
In that it's like you have these various factors, like I just mentioned, so the social communication and the repetitive and restrictive behaviors and the sensory things, but no two autistic people will have exactly the same sort of presentations or difficulties or strengths. So autism's very heterogeneous in that it presents very differently in each autistic person. So the project that I'm working on is mainly looking at early signs and symptoms of autism and ADHD. So the study's called BASIS STARS. So everyone in academia loves the acronym. So it's British Autism Study of Infant Siblings, studying autism and ADHD risk.
How do you diagnose autism?
Cool. So it really depends on sort of when and where it's diagnosed, I guess. So at the moment, I think the average age of diagnosis is like 4 or 5 years old. And so the way in which it's diagnosed would be sort of like a combination of looking at developmental history. So a diagnostic sort of tool used is called the ADIR, which is like Autism Diagnostic Interview Revised. And so that's very much sort of like a semi-structured, I'd call it like almost like having a conversation with a parent about their child who they may think has autism. And it's just sort of discovering what their first concerns were, and sort of what things that they may have noticed from essentially going back all the way from birth.
Okay, so how does it work? Like, so you is it like you sit in a room with just the parent, or?
So yeah, you can do. You can you'd sit with the parent typically. I mean, it can be done over the phone, but I think that's sometimes less personable. I think it's definitely that sort of sit with the parent, and you would essentially, you have like a booklet full of questions, but essentially you're going through those questions, trying to explore and understand what the parent has noticed from sort of very early on, if anything. And obviously not all of the questions may be relevant, considering what I've said about how different autism can present in different individuals, but that's something that you go through. And then another aspect of diagnosing autism is looking at it behaviorally. So there's sort of a very commonly used diagnostic tool, which is called the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, number two.
Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule.
There we go. Which is
ADOS.
Yes, great. So everyone loves an acronym, like I said. And so that's a semi-structured sort of behavioural assessment that a trained researcher or a clinician would do with the person who is suspected to be autistic. And so that comprises of sort of a number of different tasks, and you're looking out for behaviors that would typically sort of be considered autistic,
like markers or something, or
I guess you could call them behavioral markers. You're looking, yeah, because it is essentially diagnosed as we speak right now, it's diagnosed behaviorally. So you're looking out for these behavioral things, and combining that with parental sort of informant, if that's available.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I guess that also depends on when you're diagnosed, because, yeah, if you're an adult, slightly different.
Autism is a lot more common than most people realise. There are around 700,000 people on the autism spectrum here in the UK, according to data from the National Autistic Society. So that's more than 1 in 100. Now, if you include their families in that, autism is part of daily life for just around 3 million people. Data from the NHS shows that between January and October 2018, there are around 18,000 new referrals for patients with suspected autism. But stepping away from the numbers, what does it mean to be diagnosed?
When I was 17, halfway through college, basically, I had been not... I wasn't a bad kid. Just my grades had just started to do a mad one and they were like, what is happening? So I had one economics teacher that tested us every week. Like, it wasn't just a, oh, here's a practice question. It was a full-on test. And I'd smash one week and do bad the next. But if you'd look at the questions, I was doing bad on, like, there wasn't a pattern. It wasn't as if it was one specific topic I didn't know. It was just generally whatever was going on in my life that week was having a massive impact. Like, I was always late. I was sleeping in lessons, like, and they were like, what is wrong with you? And I was like, well, if I knew, it wouldn't be wrong. So my form tutor was the head of the special educational needs, I don't know if they call it a unit, at the college. And she was like, yeah, I think there's something a bit up with you. Can you go? Well, not can you go. You're going to have to go to CAMHS, Child Adolescent Mental Health Service. Otherwise, like, you're getting kicked out of college because, like, you're not doing what you need to do to be here. So obviously I went because I wanted to go to uni at that point. And they did an assessment and immediately, like, noticed I was depressed and had anxiety. They couldn't quite work out if it was anxiety or social anxiety because I did cadets at the time, which is a really social thing to do. Then the assessor picked up things about my past and how I was now that were just, like, triggered her to do a autism assessment, and that's how I found out I was autistic.
Wow, and so, like, what was it like finding out that you're autistic? Yeah, what was it like?
It didn't mean anything to me because I didn't know what it was at the time.
Yeah, I mean,
there was a bit of a relief in the fact that, oh, okay, there's something I can say as to why I'm, like, when I obviously every teen naps, but I would sleep. Like, it wasn't, I would lose a whole day. Like, I'd go to, you know, sometimes you haven't, like, oh, I'll just put my head down for 5 minutes. Turns out it's a couple of hours later. It's a day later. And I've usually missed half the next day as well. Like, it would be, because I'd push myself thinking I was able to do things that everyone else could do, which now I know, like, you have your limits, respect them, because it'll have a knock-on effect and make the week even worse. But yeah, so now it was just a case of, I had a word. I didn't really receive any help as to how to come up with strategies to address it. I didn't even get my paperwork through because I stopped going to the CBT for the depression that I had at the time. So they just stopped with everything they had in relation to me.
So you were diagnosed at 17. I mean, did you have any inkling before that that something was up?
So when I was around, I'd say seven or eight, I was always getting in trouble. And then as a result of that, so I was always sat down with teachers a lot and they'd be like, oh, who are your friends? I'm like, well, I don't have friends. I'm like, well, you play with so and such. I was like, yeah, but they're all friends and I'm not friends with them. They're not friends with me. And looking back now, could I have been any more autistic? Like, what did you, what, if that doesn't scream there's something, like, different about this child, then what would have? I used to spend my lunch times, again, in primary school, we had a choir and we had, back in the day, so everything was on paper, we had the choir folders. I would optionally, in the height of summer, I mean, I had hay fever, but even in winter, like, just any time of year, I would go and organise about 70 choir folders, putting in all the hymn sheets and songs for the whole choir, and I'd smash it. I'd do it so quick. And then whenever I was excluded, I think she was the deputy head, was also in charge of the choir. So if she had choir things to do, she'd be really annoyed that I was excluded that week. Like, you could tell. And I'd come back and, like, she'd have got someone else to do it and it'd be a mess. And she'd be like, right, Tyler, do you want to do the choir? I was like, yeah, I'll come in and I'll sort it out. Don't worry. So I'd go sit in her office. So looking back to then, you've got a kid who likes organising things and who has no friends. And I mean, I know these are stereotypes, but if that's all we've got as key indicators as to whether you should assess a child or not, when I'm in trouble and hiding under tables and in cupboards and you can't find me and I'm escaping school three times, what did you think? Why did you think I was doing that? And then in high school, the way I do my work, I did textiles, which is project-based? I guess, it's coursework. So you end up doing a portfolio and then you'd make a couple of things and write about them. And deadline was approaching, because obviously it's GCSE, so you're going off the national deadlines and stuff. And my teacher was like, you've not done your work yet. I'm like, yeah, don't worry, I'm ready. She's like, what do you mean you're ready? Just do the work. I was like, yeah, but it's not due yet. Like, yeah, but I need to mark it on this date. You'll have it by that date, don't worry. I'm like, right, I'm going to have to put you on detention because I don't have any of your work. And I don't, like, she knew I was capable. She didn't have a worry, but she needed to see something just to, like, make sure I was in line with the rest of the class or whatever. I was like, right, but you're not marking it yet, so why am I making it? I'm like, right, well, you're on detention. So I spent about 6 weeks on detention. She still got no work out of it, so I don't know why she bothered to do it, because it just wasted her lunch times as well. But when it came to the day, I think I did my whole portfolio, written portfolio, in about a week, maybe less than that. And it was supposed to have taken about two terms. And then in terms of the practical stuff, I would just knock out designs and like finish products within two or three days, or two or three classes. And again, it was meant to take longer than that. And I know like people naturally have skills towards some things, but it was a case of I work better under pressure, and like, not even pressure, but just give me a block of time to just get it done, leave me alone, rather than doing bits and bits as time goes on, which is how they wanted me to work. And then again, while I was in school as well, I just didn't like this. I think it was worse in primary school, but I didn't like the start of a new school year. Like every time I would, even if I liked the teacher, I didn't want to go into their class. I remember year 2 to 3 was the worst, because naturally, like, I've got a new playground, got a new teacher. You go from juniors to, what was it? Was it seniors? It wasn't seniors.
Yeah, it was juniors to seniors, I think.
I think, was it? Yeah. So, everything about that I hated. I also actually did not like that teacher, which made it even worse. So I'd constantly just like get up and walk out of a class, go to the toilet and then not come back. And I get that on, like, it's just a disruptive child, but then when you put everything together, there's something more there deep down. They just thought I had behavioural problems. So primary school, I was sent to a behavioural therapist, but they didn't pick up on my autistic traits. They just thought I was another naughty kid.
I mean, why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think they thought you were just another naughty kid?
I was a black kid in a predominantly white school. I think there was three black kids in my class and probably 10 in a school of 500, sorry. Was it 1,000? It was a big primary school, I know that much. And then, like, again, single parent household and, like, all these other little things, which to them it's probably like, oh, she's not been raised right or something like that. And it's just like, when you've got a child who gets 10 out of 10 on a spelling test, but tells you they got 7, why would they do that? And I still do the same now. Like, if anyone puts me up for awards and stuff, I don't like getting them. I don't like doing it. Like, I think at that point in primary school, if you started getting like 10s and stuff, you were getting awards and prizes and stuff like that. But then that would bring attention to you. And I hated attention on me. Like, I don't mind doing well and give me an odd little, oh, well done. But that needs to be the line. If I start getting like golden jumper, I hated getting that. Like, I hated.
Sorry, what? A golden jumper?
But like the best behaved, or like if you did something outstanding, or if you were really nice to a friend or something, you'd get the golden jumper, because our school jumpers were blue. So you'd get a yellow one. And not only had that jumper been worn by every other child in the class, which is disgusting, they then, you got to stand up in assembly, go up and get the jumper. And I hated doing it. I didn't like it.
I mean, did it happen often?
Well, it happened at least once a year, because everyone in the class ended up getting the golden jumper. But then the weekly thing was the spelling tests. And I genuinely got into arguments with teachers, because they'd have to mark down your score. Someone else would have marked your test. I'd say I got a 7. Who marked it would shout out, oh no, she got a 10. I'm taking less. What's the problem? Like, what is your issue? Leave me to, I want a 7. I've got the right to take a 10, but I want a 7. So, it would have been about 9 at the time, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh, damn. So this kid would say to you, like, oh, like, shout out that you've got a higher mark than you...
than the one I wanted.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, is that something you find yourself doing even now, like downplaying things?
A lot, yeah. So I struggle in, like, interviews and my CV doesn't really reflect what I am and all this stuff. Like, I'm just a very... even with this whole being present online thing, it's not about me. It's not under my name. It really easily could have been, and it probably would have been easier if it was, but I don't, like, it's not about me. The end goal is to help other autistic people, and if I'm the one that's doing it, then cool. But if someone comes along in 2 weeks and does exactly what I'm thinking of doing in the way that I'd have done it, then I'll back off. I don't care. It's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of a really interesting mindset there. I think it's something you don't see often with people now. They're like, I want to be the top. I want to be the front.
Can you be bothered? That's effort. Like, if I've got to do it, then I'll do it. And at the minute, I do have to do it, so I am doing it. But no.
I mean, why do you feel like you have to do it? And when you're talking about it, sort of, what do you mean?
It in terms of filling the gap between... filling the space that there is because of the lack of social services for... what would you call it? Just for young adult autistic people, and then ones who have lower support needs also find that there's like then nothing, not even there's just nothing.
Nothing at all.
Not catered for them.
As with many conditions, hidden ones especially, there's a fear that people can end up falling through the cracks. Now, 17% of autistic children have been suspended from school, with almost 50% of these having been suspended 3 times or more. And when it comes to adults, at least 1 in 3 autistic adults are experiencing severe mental health difficulties due to a lack of support. And considering that autism is a hidden condition, is there something that researchers can do to make tests more accurate?
You've talked about behavioural markers. You know, we're looking at behavioural markers developmentally, you know, as a child, but then they also look at it in adults. And adults, they can look at a lot of the same behaviours.
Yeah.
But we think that there is some evidence that those behaviours might be skewed towards testing for boys rather, you know, for boys rather than girls, testing men rather than women. But how are we, like, moving forward? I mean, because I know there's some people looking at genetics of it.
There's definitely sort of a broader push towards, like, finding, in air quotes, biomarkers, so, like, biological markers, whether that's looking for behaviour or sort of particular, I'd say, like, EEG or, like...
What's EEG? So, like, brain scan.
So EEG is electroencephalogram. And so that is where you essentially would use like a cap or a net, which has sensors on it, and you're measuring sort of electrical activity at the scalp. And so it's non-invasive, it's not dangerous, and essentially it's quite it's a good tool for using with people of different ages. So we do EEG with babies as young as 5 months, and essentially you can look at the electrical signals measured at the scalp.
And so, I mean, how does that work in terms of testing or diagnosis?
So at the moment, it's still definitely in development in that sort of field, I'd say.
So with EEG, is there the issue that when you're looking at brain signals, just like you can't broadly say that these are autistic behaviours, wouldn't there be an issue that you couldn't say, oh, these are autistic brain patterns, if that makes sense?
Like you say, like with behaviours, so there's the behaviours that you'd say are more likely, that you'd more likely see in an autistic person, right? Whereas with EEG, it's very much sort of, I'd say, in its development for... like you, I don't think you'd be able to confidently use EEG at the moment to sort of diagnose autism, especially because a lot of it is based on like group differences. So if you're looking at like averaging data from autistic people and then averaging data from non-autistic people, a lot of sort of the variance within those groups will sort of be averaged out. And so bear in mind that we've already sort of touched on the fact that autism is very heterogeneous. So there's a lot of differences within that autistic group. And so by averaging, you're kind of sort of treating that group as one.
So to understand it, you know, there's such a wide variety in how autism presents.
Yeah.
So trying to pick behaviors, you know, actual physical behaviors, it can be difficult.
Yeah.
So even trying to pick like brain signals, because of how, you know, how varied our brains are, you know, how varied every human being's brain is.
Yeah.
If you're focusing on people who we think are, you know, autistic, looking at their brain signals, it might be very difficult to pick one thing out.
Yeah.
Especially if you're looking at them as a group of people, because it just gets fuzzy. It's just quite difficult to look at.
Well, exactly. And I think when looking at a lot of the research, it's important to remember that, like, that a lot of the data has sort of just been sort of put together. And although we might see, and we do see some differences in children who go on to have autism, and when you're comparing them to children who don't, you'll see some differences perhaps in the lab and around, you know, specific experiments and specific like components within EEG. I'd say at the moment we can't reliably say that we have sort of a biomarker tool that is 100% accurate every single time. And I think it's important to remember that. And a lot more research is needed with different groups, cross-culturally, different ethnicities across the globe. Like, a lot more research is needed, because even where you do sort of say, okay, fine, this might be evidence for a biomarker, that needs to be replicated and tested in different groups. There's some literature and research going on in various different groups, which suggests that it might be more difficult sometimes to diagnose autism in women than in men. And that might be based around the sort of the ways in which autism is currently defined and the diagnostic tools that are used to diagnose autism. And also, I think I have to bear in mind that there may be sort of other maybe protective factors or, but I think it's also important to look at why that might be, but also what sort of impact it might have on women. You're looking out for these symptoms specifically in boys, and so they might not present in the same way in girls. And considering sort of socially, are you seeing differences with boys versus girls? Like, it's, I think it's an interesting area of research that isn't specifically my area, but definitely there are differences that I think more research is needed to explore what autism looks like in different contexts.
So chatting to Mary, I was getting more of an idea of just how much these diagnoses, they require watching for certain behaviours, both in the clinical setting with experts and at home with parents, caregivers, family. What if your culture at home isn't really what the test expects? Would how you look at autism be different if you were from Sri Lanka or the Philippines or Egypt or Ghana, generally places where white European isn't the norm? I mean, does it matter if the languages spoken there don't even have a word for autism?
A really good question. And like you say, like I wouldn't know, for example, the word for autism in Twi, like directly translating it. And I think that's where we have to be mindful that like we are researching things within a certain context. So I think it's important that tools are developed to be used within the context that the autistic child is in. So I know there's sort of some research doing looking at early intervention or early diagnosis in different parts of Africa. So for example, in Ethiopia and so on. But I know that the current diagnostic tools that are used, there are some translations available, but not, of course, not in all languages. And so I think it's something that definitely needs more research to understand and to be able to contextualize what it means within a certain culture, like what autism is within the culture that you're looking at. Yeah,
but that's the thing, because for instance, you know, my parents are Ghanaian.
Yeah, as are mine.
Okay, good. We're not related, just
no,
people
no
listening.
No, not, yeah. All black people are related. Okay. just for clarity,
here in the UK, so culturally at home we're it's more Ghanaian.
Definitely.
But out in the world, it's more British. Yeah. If you're multicultural.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of autism, what would, like autism would look, so it would look so different. Yeah. And not have the frameworks currently to sort of see that, especially, you know, and this is for a lot of people of colour and whatnot.
Yeah. And I think that is, like, that's true on so many different levels. Like, even, like I say, me as a black female researcher, like, that in and of itself is an anomaly. I go to conferences and I see no one that looks like me. You're gathering and everyone's presenting their research, and in the room I don't really see anyone that looks like me, and then in the data that's been presented I don't see anyone who's, well, not often you don't see, like, black people adequately represented. So it's really difficult to navigate those spaces, I think, and to understand that there's so much, there's so many differences going on there, like, and I think right now a lot of things are being tackled sort of very separately, and that's where sort of coming together with, like, interdisciplinary approaches with research is helpful, rather than everyone doing things in their own little pockets.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So, I mean, because you were diagnosed at 17, you're how old now?
22.
So you were diagnosed at 17 and you're 22. And you mentioned that you went to uni?
Yeah, I went to Lancaster.
So what was your uni experience like? Your face right now is like, I have never seen someone roll their eyes into their mouth.
Yeah. This sums up. No, uni, innit? Like, everyone lies. I don't know why. I was lied to. It was a scam. Like, no one can tell me that they fully enjoyed uni. And if you did, then well done for you. But that's a lie. It was the whole moving out of home, living on your own. That was a breeze. Like, I've been making toast since I was like three, so I could cook a dinner. Like, that was all fine. Living with other people, again, wasn't too bad. We had a cleaner, so mess wasn't really an issue. It was, what didn't I like about you? Well, what? I wouldn't say it was a waste of time, because now you learn a lot about yourself and all that rubbish, but you'd learn it all eventually in the real world anyway. And it's just, I wouldn't do it again. I don't know what my major issue, what was my major issue with uni? You're just surrounded by people who think they know what they're on about. They don't know what they're on about. Even the lecturers only just about know what they're on about. If you ask them about something outside of their topic, they're struggling. And it's just really fake. In terms of the day-to-day, I mean, Lancaster flooded the first year I was there. Like, there's Manchester rain, yeah, but Lancaster, well done. You smashed it on that rain front. Like, it does not stop. When it, like, it's constantly drizzling, I think, it's just horrible.
You're really selling Lancaster too, because, you know, we have an international audience, and all you're saying is essentially that
don't go.
Don't go?
No.
Don't go to the north of England? Don't go to Lancaster? What are we saying here?
Don't go Lancaster. Just don't bother. It calls itself a town just because it's got a cathedral. I'm from a bigger city, and my village is the size of that town. What? That's not a town. It doesn't have a Nando's. It's not a town.
So what I am looking at on my phone is just, I'm going to mute the word Lancaster because I don't need people in my mentions. So why'd you bring Tyler on? Yeah, chatting all this Lancaster hate. Who the fuck does she think she is?
No, is it all right? I'll give you some good things about it. As a campus, it's really modern. There are a lot of support systems in place for non-autistic students, and there is a service for autistic students, but obviously it's not going to fit everyone, and it didn't really fit for me.
I mean, let's look at that. So being at uni, what was it like in terms of being autistic? Like from day one, did you feel like, cool, it's calm, I can do this? I mean, what was it like?
I just spent my summer working in like the busiest student nightclub in Manchester. So I was used to staying up late, used to fast-paced environments, used to being around students. Moving to Lancaster was it's a lot slower paced there. Got two clubs in the town. In terms of socializing, like I lived in a flat with 12 other people. So that was helpful in terms of like making friends and stuff. I also got really involved in sport. But when I'd started uni, because it was a year after my diagnosis and I hadn't really done anything to do with being autistic, I hadn't really done any research, didn't really know what it meant, I kind of forgot I was autistic. So I was just getting on with life in terms of like doing what everyone else was doing. Obviously doing things that I liked as well. So I'd go to a couple of talks and stuff with my flatmates, but I was just living the stereotypical uni student life. And that's not the kind of student life I should have done, because it laid like, yeah, everyone misses lectures here and there. But again, like with the whole sleep thing, I would miss whole days and just be out sleeping, but I wasn't tired. I was burnt out. Like there's a difference. Like I could wake up and it would be beyond being in a mood. I think there was a time, I think it was actually Freshers Week. So it's the week before uni starts and you just get to know your way around campus. For us, we had introductory lectures and also went out a lot. Yeah, it was quite a bit of drink. Well, there wasn't. It was Lancaster. There wasn't even that much drinking.
Wow, again with the Lancaster hate. Yo.
No, I'm not hating it. It's just a different way of life. I don't drink much, but they didn't drink at all. No, my flat was a very social flat. We went out every night. But so I was in my room getting ready to go out, and there was this noise in the corridor, and then there was this whole commotion. There was random people in the kitchen, and then a light had broken. So the panels in the hallway are that like hospital ceiling type stuff where it's all the squares and it's like, I don't know if it's polystyrene, I don't know what it is, but it's like tiles that you can knock out and fix a light really easily. And he'd done a backflip and knocked the light.
Wait, who'd done this backflip?
At this point, I didn't know, but I just kicked off. I was like, everyone needs to get out. I was screaming. We live next to third years. So obviously third years think they know it all because they've been there the longest. They were our fresher rep, so they look after you during the week. And they were like, calm down. I was like, don't tell me to calm down when you're in my flat. And I used to do cadets and like lead Remembrance Sunday parades. So like I'm used to shouting in the street. I brought it into the flat. And so all my flatmates were kind of shocked. And then I just didn't care at that point, because looking back now, at that time I was pretty burnt out and I just can't filter myself. I can't regulate like just my reactions or anything. What you get is what you're getting, and you've annoyed me, so this is what you're getting. I mean, it wasn't every night, but it was that night, and it was just wasn't the one. Like, there was just so many things going wrong. And at that point, I didn't know that it was my flatmate who'd done the backflip, and he did not, once my mouth opened, there was no way he was telling me that night. I think 2 weeks later, when we were like, who actually broke the light? Like, what happened? Everyone was like, because I didn't know, but everyone else knew, and they were like, it was hate. I'm not going to say it.
I can bleep it out.
No, I mean, I don't like him anyways. It's fine. I ended up living with him again and we fell out again. So, yeah, it was him. And I was like, right then. Cool. I mean, at least I didn't think we got charged for it in the end, but if we did, it would have been hefty.
Since graduating from university, one of the most interesting things that Tyler's been up to is her work online, educating people about autism and what it's like being an autistic individual transitioning into adulthood.
So I got in touch with you because you're Black, you're autistic, you have a website, Adulting Autistic, an Instagram, also Adulting Autistic. Yep. The brand is strong here. Very, very strong brand.
YouTube's also the same. Yeah, yeah, I've carried it all the way through. Yeah.
How did that start, that wanting to show people what it's like being you?
Because, well, there was like two different reasons. One is like, there are all these vloggers and like, even the air quotes, authentic ones, and their struggles are things that like I wish were my problems, in the fact that falling out with friends kind of would be cool if I had friends to begin with, like, or deciding like what I eat in a week and being able to eat more than like the one meal because you've had a mental block as to like how to do a food shop, or you can't leave the house today because something else has gone wrong, and like all these things that I had a meeting like a couple of weekends ago and I was supposed to do something before it. So I planned my whole day in accordance to having two things, like this structure, this was my calendar. These are the orders that I was doing things in. And I'd known that for about 3 days. I then decided myself not to go to the first thing, which then made me an hour and a half late to the next thing. And that happens like all the time. If I change a little thing, even if it's for the better, I'll just be off kilter for definitely that day, potentially 2 or 3 days after that. And it's like, no one really knows what the life of an autistic person is. Like, everyone just assumes they know what it's like. And like, oh, they can't do this, they can't do that. And it's like, no, we can sometimes under these conditions, or if these accommodations are made. And then it's like, well, what is it like behind closed doors? What do you actually experience day to day? And because I find it so hard to put things into words, it's easy for me to just show you.
Burnt out now. Let me... Oh, I'm going to have for lunch.
And one thing I've seen sort of through your social media is about food. I mean, you talk about food, I want to say a fair bit, and one thing in particular is about eating sort of plain meals.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me a bit about your food habits?
The thing, the easiest, like whenever I'm going out for dinner or something, and someone's picking where to eat, they're like, oh, what kind of food do you like? I was like, just imagine me as a 6'5" old. That's what I like to eat.
Oh, a 6'5" old.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I always end, when I'm eating out, I either go for like a steak or like the closest thing to nuggets, chips, or a burger. But then my burger, like, I don't like sauces, so like any condiments. The thing, the only one I like is gravy. I can do a curry, but you have to take the chicken out, and it's just coated in the sauce. It's not like actually in the sauce. And if the sauce is on top of the rice, I'm not eating it. Or if it is going to be like that, I have to be in control of like how much sauce I want. Like, so I can't, other people will do my food. It's really complicated. And then if like, there'll be sometimes I'll get a, be trying something new. And when I say new, I mean like there'll be a different herb in there. And it's close to what I already like, but because it's slightly different, it will take me forever to eat. So in like public settings or around other people, it's like, oh, do you not like your food? It's like, no, I do like it. I'm just getting used to it. And then by the time I'm used to it, it's cold. So so I can't eat it. Yeah.
Yeah, this sounds annoying as shit.
A little bit. It's like, well, so the types of things I tend to eat are, at the minute in rotation, we have a sausage casserole, well, bean stew type thing, which is new. Perfecting that recipe at the minute. And then we've got spaghetti bolognese, which is like a classic. But then it'll be on days where if I've had an overstimulating day, or I'm in a bit of a, I don't know what mood, I'll just go for comfort food, but my comfort food tends to look like just a plate of chips, nothing with it, a bit of salt if I'm feeling fancy, but or maybe it's like a bowl of pasta with nothing. And I think I had rice noodles one time and they were peng.
So Tyler's work, be it writing or Instagram stories or YouTube, it serves the purpose of allowing individuals who are neurotypical to get an idea of what it's like to be an autistic individual. And more importantly, what it's like living in a society that doesn't really understand you.
What are some of the things that society sees as negative when they come across autistic people? I know it's a sort of a wide spectrum.
Yeah. It's just the lack of acceptance of someone doing something different or just appearing, as you'd say, weird. It's like, if I want to sit down and the floor's clean, I'll sit down, I don't care. But in certain places or in certain situations, that's not appropriate. And I was like, my feet hurt. Why am I not, like, why can't I sit down? But then in that situation, you've got one random girl sat on the floor, and I get how it would then look weird, but I'm not bothering you. Leave me alone. Another situation would be using ear defenders in public, which I don't do, but quite a few autistic people do. I mean, now that like Bose headphones are so big, they kind of blend in a bit more, but being in public spaces and using ear defenders or tinted lenses or just a lot of the accessories and things that we use to either soothe ourselves or just stay a lot calmer, reduce anxiety in public, then are also causes for people to point us out or say that we're even more different. And it's just like, well, we can't win.
So I mean, why do people wear these things, you know, these ear defenders or tinted shades or what have you?
You know, when you would like go to the library to study or do something like that and you want to stay focused or you just want to get your work done and not be disturbed, that's how we need, that's the level of, not care, but the level of effort we need to put into just getting through the day. That's the parallel. Like, if, so when I was walking here today, I had my earphones in and I didn't have any music playing, but I had to have my earphones in because I couldn't focus on like staying on track of getting to the building because there's a lot of street noise, there are a lot of people about, there's like it's sensory overload, and then just also the thing of distraction and forgetting what you're actually doing, and there's loads of little things. They were just, I feel like I'm a magnet for everything's just pulling me in loads of different directions. So that's what the things help to do. They either help to keep you calm or keep you on task or just get through the day in whatever way you need to.
So growing up, do you live with your mum?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did your mum understand
about this? I've been really independent since I was about 16, so it didn't really matter.
You're a black woman, you're 6'1", and you're autistic.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like it can throw up like a whole lot of difficulties and sort of people not expecting.
Yeah, I'm not fitting in.
Yeah, you don't feel like you fit in? Really?
Where are you putting me where I fit in? I think I'm always in the minority, no matter what setting I'm in, but I mean, with intersectionality, you get that with a lot of people. So does anyone really fit in anywhere? I think one of the reasons my diagnosis took so long to come about is because I was in predominantly white settings growing up. And then it wasn't until college where I was in a more diverse college. And my tutor was able to see that it wasn't just disregard for education. Like, I clearly wanted to be there and I was able. I just wasn't capable under the settings. And then in day to day, in general, like, just in the minority, it is what it is. Like, I don't really see it as, there's nothing I can do about it unless we like populate the world with more autistic and black people. Like, what am I gonna do?
Now, while it might not be possible for us to intentionally populate the world with black autistic individuals, it is possible for neurotypical people to get a better idea of the experiences of autistic individuals. And in some cases, it's about emotions.
Basically, alexithymia exists, can exist in autistic people and non-autistic people. It's just, again, one of those things that autistic people are more likely to experience. Basically, it means no words for feelings, so you struggle to explain what you're going through. For me, it can feel like I'm suffocated and I don't really know what's going on. Like, I could be really happy sometimes and I actually don't know. Like, if you ask me on the spot, like, oh, how are you doing today, I don't know. Like, I don't really. If you genuinely want an answer, you're going to have to give me like 2 working days. yeah. So alexithymia then makes it, it's one of the factors. I've just done a podcast with someone who researched it and she was saying that it's one of the factors that makes autistic people more likely to self-harm, but it is also something that mirrors the general population. But then because autistic people are more likely to have alexithymia, it makes them more likely to self-harm, if you draw that link. We then fall into like the self-harm just to feel something and know it, what it is that you're feeling like. I know what pain feels like because if you do this, that causes that thing and that's pain. I fall into binge eating when I don't know what I'm feeling or if I... Yeah, it tends to be when I don't know what I'm feeling in general, or if I think I'm sad or I'm not really sure, then I'll binge eat and see if I feel better or don't feel that same feeling after. And if I do, then I was sad. Or if I, at the minute when I do it, I still find out if I do it and after I've done it, I've still got the same feeling. So I don't think that helps me solve the feeling of what I think is sadness at the minute anymore. So it's another disconnect between feelings and communication, and when it's something that's internal as well, like no one really knows to know, no one else really needs to know what you're feeling, but if you don't know yourself, then it's really annoying.
It can be very tough.
It's because if like when you're in a bad mood and you present like you're in a bad mood, you do things that someone in a bad mood would do, but you actually don't realize you're in a bad mood, it then affects all the people that you're around as well, because you don't know what's caused it. You don't know who said something and done something. You don't know whether you've done something yourself that you shouldn't do again to prevent that feeling or happening again. So it's just, you're in a different headspace, but you don't know whether it's happy, sad, annoyed, like anxious, you know?
And that's something that you felt your entire life, or?
Now that I'm more aware of what emotions are, I know I experienced it, but I don't know if I experienced it much as a child, because when I was a child, the only feelings that I'd really experienced were extremes. So I'd be like, and it was mostly on like the negative side. So I'd be really angry, really frustrated. And I also couldn't, oh yeah, I guess I've always had it, because I also really couldn't communicate with teachers when I was feeling any type of way. Like, and as I said before, like there are some parts of my life that are impacted by being autistic that I wish kind of didn't happen. Like, I'm late a lot. I kind of wish that didn't happen. And that's because I can't stay on task when I'm getting ready, or because of slight changes. And my responses to like sensory responses, again, if you can do something with that, then I might be willing to listen. But at the same time, a lot of autistic people are given medication, which tackles things like that, and some of them love it, some of them have it against their will. But again, that's a kind of a different conversation.
I mean, touching on that a little bit, I mean, you're saying there's sort of medication for various aspects, of it. Have you ever taken any medication or
no?
Yeah,
I was offered antidepressants but didn't take them because my fear with medication is that I didn't, again, because of alexithymia, like I didn't really understand that I was depressed. So what would happen when I started taking this medication and I couldn't really feel that I wasn't depressed? Or am I just supposed to take it for the rest of my life? Because as far as I'm aware, that's not something you're supposed to take forever. You're supposed to be able to come off them at some point, but if I don't know why I'm on them, how am I going to know when I'm ready to come off?
One of the big things that people talk about is when they talk about autism, that, I mean, I see online in lots of different blogs and stuff like that, because, you know, looking about this stuff, when I found you, I wanted to research a bit more about it. People talk about autism as a superpower. I mean, you just roll your, like rolling your eyes so hard right there.
I understand saying autism's superpower brings some people some comfort. If that works for you, then cool. But again, to brand it as something that's a superpower, you're disregarding all other things that you do actually find difficult. And I'm not saying that there's a thing you should focus on, but when you say it's your superpower, say why. Because a lot of the times people are saying, oh, I can hyperfocus, which, yeah, you are able to do because you are autistic, or I have a special interest in X or in certain type of thing, which I've been able to monetize, or I know a lot, I'm really good at general knowledge quizzes because, again, that's your special interest. Like, you're missing something out when you brand autism as a superpower, and it also trivializes it to some extent and could potentially be the reason why people, autistic people who have lower support needs, are not getting the help they need.
If I'm honest, I wish more people knew, like, just recognized autistic people at, like, from the person perspective, like taking the time to understand and know that there may be differences in the way in which you see the world, but also that autism isn't sort of your stereotypical Hollywood, like, Rain Man or what's that recent one, The Accountant with Ben Affleck. So that was, like, I remember seeing that on Netflix quite recently, but it's a couple years old. But, like, autism isn't something that only affects white men, and they're not all savants, like, with these sort of special abilities. Like, every autistic person is so different, and everyone will have what are strengths for them, but also difficulties. And it's also, I think, I wish people could recognize that it's not just being autistic that can sometimes present with difficulties for these autistic individuals. So, for example, it's the co-occurring things that some people find most difficult to deal with, and that's whether that's anxiety or OCD or epilepsy and so on, like also ADHD, which we know highly co-occurs with autism. I think it's important to remember that there's a number of things that may be sort of disentangled there.
Now, what Mary's just said is really interesting to me, because as someone with epilepsy, I know that there are a lot of other conditions linked to it. And what that means for me is that anytime I hear about new news about the subject, I go away and I just research. So I wonder, is Tyler the same way? Do you spend, like, a lot of time reading research papers about autism?
I do a quick Google and read the abstract, but yeah. I wouldn't say I go in depth with the papers. But it's just because the more I know, the more I can explain to other people about autism. Like, if I just came in today and said, like, so this morning you asked me what I had for breakfast, and I was like, well, I've not actually eaten, I've only just realised. It's like, well, how do you forget to eat? If I just said, because I'm autistic, then that's like, there's a missing part there. So if I say it's because interception's a sense, which then, and interception's a sense, and then being autistic, we have difficulty with all senses. So then it was because I'm autistic, I struggled with interception, which meant that I forgot to eat this morning. I only come across papers that I need. So if I'm wondering if there's a link between autism and insomnia, then I'll search for that and find out. So those papers don't tend to be annoying. In terms of autism in the news, so a couple of weeks ago, there was a breakthrough in a study using this, I think it's a drug that's used for thinning bodily fluids or something. It's used for something at the minute and it's safe, but they've noticed there's a link between it and curing autism. And so I did a little bit of research into whatever they claim to be doing, and they're using a scale, and I don't know what the scale's called, but they're using some sort of scale and it has a mix of factors on it. They've not publicly released which factors the new pill affects to do with autism. If a kid makes eye contact more, that's going to have less of a benefit to their life than if they're able to sleep, or if they're able to regulate their thoughts. Like, I struggle with staying on a single, single task, or just like one stream of thought, because quite a few things distract me. And if there was something that could help with that, then I would take that. But if you're making it so that I'm able to, basically, the approach that a lot of research that's not led by autistic people, or just quite a lot of the research that annoys autistic people does, is it tries to make it so that autistic people can operate in a world in a way that neurotypical people, so non-autistic people, like quite a lot of therapists are targeting things such as flapping or stimming, which actually don't cause, well, some stims do. There's like verbal stimming and then there's like physical stimming. So some people repeat words, some people make noises, some people like do some sort of movement. So because, I don't know how to, some people might disagree with my explanation of it, but basically I stim mostly when I'm excited, or if I've been sat down for a long time and just like need, like it's just a release of energy. So like I noticed the other day I got some news through, and then I just like put my arms up and like waved them. I was like in my room on my own. I was like, what have I just done? Because I'm not conscious or aware when I'm stimming. It's not really something that you think to do. It's more of a reaction and you just do it.
I mean, okay, so again, this is an audio medium, so you lot listening can't see, but when we talk about arms in the air, are we talking round the side, straight up?
It's just whatever you don't control it. Whatever you do is what you just do. So for me, it was like hands above my head and just like move my wrists and my hands move. But for everyone, they just do different things. And I think when I was a child, I used to bang my head against my bedroom wall. But that was frustration because I couldn't verbalize my, I couldn't verbalize what was wrong. So I'd do that to again release what I thought was like release the energy and just move on. If the reason you're stopping them from, some people stim by banging their head against a wall. So if the reason you're stopping them from banging their head against the wall is so that you're more comfortable and so that it's all right for you to look like see them just doing nothing, then that's daft. What you actually need to do is find a substitute and use the therapy to do that instead. So that's what annoys me about the research, is a lot of it is for the benefit of the neurotypical world rather than for the benefit of the patient.
I agree with Tyler in that autism is a difference, and it's important to remember that we're not talking about like a disease like cancer or something like that, in that it needs to be cured necessarily. And I think that's a very difficult sort of topic to cover as a researcher, but what I will say is that there's definitely, I think, some harmful narratives that you see perhaps like in the media and on Twitter around that sort of thing, sort of like curing autism. And I think that people could just be a bit more responsible with the ways in which they're talking about people here. These are autistic people. Autism's a difference, and I think it's important to sort of understand, or make as much of an attempt to understand what their world is like, rather than trying to cure it. I guess that's sort of sometimes society's position on a lot of things, like anything that's other or different. It's like, okay, you do that in your own space rather than sort of in public. But I think it's definitely not
good.
I think it's harmful. It can be damaging.
Trying to design a cure for autism is, let's say, problematic at best. So with that in mind, I had one final question to ask Tyler. Okay, so with everything we've spoken about, you know,
from your diagnosis, you know, mental health, living through uni, all the way to like understanding and really probing, you know, what scientists are trying to do, you know, chatting to Mary and really thinking about why some scientists are so hung up on the cure. How would you want people to go away and explain autism and, you know, what you feel society needs to do better, like in the future, to make things better for autistic people?
Autism impacts every aspect of your life. It's challenging at times, just like it is for like everyone else to live. But then on top of that, we have this different way of thinking, which means that we're usually not on the same page or even not in the same book as you. And it's not through choice. We're not trying to be difficult, and it would be a lot easier for everyone if we could communicate in a way that we can both understand. I think they've got this one example that I use a lot when I was explaining what autism is. It's like, so you have an iPhone, you send an iMessage to someone with an Android, delivers as text. The information's there, but you're a little bit gutted it's green. So the meet in the middle point would be to use WhatsApp. So then your message is sent exactly and you know how it's being delivered. So there are these things that we could use. So again, WhatsApp's an additional thing. You've had to download it, you've had to use it, but it's an extra step, but it means you're getting the message through how you want it through. And that's kind of the world we need to build so that non-autistic people can communicate with autistic people. We just need to find the WhatsApps we need.
I'd like to say a massive thank you to Tyler and Mary for coming on, sharing all of their knowledge, and of course, all of the researchers that we've spoken to. Now, I'm not going to name you individually, and this is for one key reason. Imagine I name you individually, right? And your friend listens to this podcast. Let's not even say a friend, let's say a coworker, right? They hear your name, and then they're like, what? Why didn't Alex get in touch with me? I study the exact same area. I could have given you even more knowledge. Why? And then jealousy builds and resentment, and then you've lost a friend. But more importantly, we've lost a listener. So come on, understand where we're at. If you want to find Tyler on the internet, you can see her YouTube channel at Adulting Autistic. Now, both Tyler and Mary are on Twitter as well, so I'll put their accounts in the show notes. Join us again next episode, where Hannah's doing a deep dive into infertility, IVF, and what can only be described as unnecessary sex chat.
So aunties coming up to me and said, oh, so what have the doctors said about your chances of getting pregnant? And part of me wanted to say, well, if I did ask a doctor, they would probably advise me to stop using contraception because we haven't started trying yet. You know, so there was obviously an assumption that, of course, she started trying for kids because that's what people do.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.